to me to have the opportunity to address this audience. Appreciate especially those visiting with us. Some have come from some distance to be here, as has been mentioned, from down in Bibb County and from other places. We're thankful. Everybody here, very welcome. And we hope and pray that we'll put the time at this time to good use. I was thinking about the first time I ever saw anybody worshiping an idol or an idol shrine in person. And I grew up in Pleasant Grove. You don't just find those on every corner. It's not exactly Athens of old. But I'll tell you, when you think about it, you realize that actually there are more people in the world, even today, who worship idols than those that don't. You combine and lump all the different religions together that involve somebody bowing down before some man-made statue. And you realize that the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's an old method of trying to approach God. And certainly as you read the Bible, you can find a number of examples of that very thing. When you read the Old Testament, for example, you read about the goddess Ashtoreth, sometimes Astarte, sometimes Ishtar. You know, we learned in our old history classes that, you know, the Greeks would have a god and the Romans would borrow it, and one might call the god Zeus and another might call it Jupiter, or one Hermes and one Mercury, but the same gods borrowed by different peoples. And we find that same thing in the Old Testament. Ashtoreth, Ishtari, is found in the Old Testament. In 1 Samuel, you remember chapter 31, the story there of the destruction of Saul. And when Saul was killed by the Philistines, they took his armor, 1 Samuel 31 says, and they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth. They fastened his wall by the body of Bethshan. You know, it wasn't just the Philistines that worshipped Ashtoreth. We find that it was a problem among the Israelites. And the reason for that, the book of Judges makes plain over and over again, is because Israel did a sorry job of conquering the land. They did not destroy as they should have the remnants of idolatry. And because of that, later on, it was a great trouble to them. I'm reading from Judges chapter 2 now. One of several examples that we could read, where after the death of Joshua, Israel soon was worshiping the gods of Canaan. They forsook the Lord, verse 13 says, and they served Baal and Ashtaroth. We find this again later on in the United Kingdom, in the divided kingdom, I should say. I'm turning over to 2 Kings chapter 21. During the days of Manasseh, you are familiar with his reign and the extreme wickedness that took hold of Israel during that period of time. In 2 Kings chapter 21 and verse 3, Manasseh spent his early years trying his best to undo all the good that Hezekiah had done. He built up again, this is verse 3 of 2 Kings 21, he built up again the high places which Hezekiah his father hath destroyed. And he reared up altars for Baal, and made a grove, and did Ahab, the king of Israel. And he worshipped all the host of heaven. He made a grove, the text says. Back in verse 7 again, he set a graven image of the grove he had made in the house which the Lord said to David and to Solomon, in this house I have chosen out of all Israel to put my name forever. The word grove, if you have the King James Version, is simply the word Ashtoreth. And it seems that there was a connection there because they would plant groves. And then they would take maybe one or several of the trees in this grove, and they would cut the top out of it, and they would shave the limbs off of it, take the bark off of it, and sometimes carve an image in honor of Ashtoreth. And so that's why in the Old Testament you'd hear about the groves. Well, the groves here were not just simply a grove of trees, but a grove that were devoted to idols. And in this case, Manasseh at one point apparently cut one of these things down and took it into the temple. But Ashtoreth was a problem. It was a plague to Israel. When you think about how history tells us this goddess was honored, she was the goddess of love. She was the moon goddess. And if you went to the temple of Ashtoreth, you might get your fortune told. But more than likely, what made it popular was the ritualized prostitution that took place there. We think about a world given to dissipation, but imagine a religion that is set up for the purpose of committing fornication. Well, a fertility goddess would bring fertility to your crop, to your family, and so this very carnal approach to religion and putting God on the level of fornication is what the worship of Ashtoreth was all about. Let me take another example. And that's the example of Chemosh. Now, this is a very different kind of god, isn't it? The word Chemosh means destroyer, it seems like. And so when you think about Chemosh, you're thinking about a god of war, a bloodthirsty god. There's a story over in 2 Kings chapter 3 that comes to mind. In 2 Kings 3, it's a very strange picture. You may remember the setting here. During the divided kingdom, we have the king of Israel, Joram of Israel. And Joram wants to make war against Moab. They've rebelled against him. And so he calls to his assistance Edom and the king of Judah, who at this time is Jehoshaphat, who was a man who had many qualities but was not careful about the company he kept. And so here is this strange, odd lot. We'll not go into the story tonight, but it's an interesting story about how they almost died in the desert and God seems to have had mercy on them. But they made war against Moab. And they were able to perhaps give Moab a wound, but somehow fell short of all of their gold. In the midst of this conflict, there's a story, the point I want to make, is in verse 27, when it says that the king of Edom couldn't break through as he wanted to, and so he took his eldest son, the last verse of chapter 3 tells us, the king of Moab took his eldest son that should have reigned in his stead and offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. And it so shocked and appalled those who saw it, especially it seems in Edom, that it caused a rift among the allies. Here is a God who would call on you to commit murder, the murder of your own child. Slaying the son, that was Chemosh. By the way, you may recognize, over here this big rock is what's famously known as the Moabite stone. You can go over to Paris today to the basement of the Louvre. You can see here is a stone that was created at the order of Mesha, the king of Moab. And of course, it's written from his point of view, and he writes about how that for a long time, Chemosh, our god here, was mad at him, and therefore they were under the thumb of the Israelites. But eventually they were able to overcome. But on this stone, we read about the son of Omri, we read about the son of the house of David, we read about Jehovah. All of these verified by history, not connected with that which would be pro-Israel, but recognizing even from its enemies the reality of the Old Testament story. But Chemosh is the point, and Chemosh is certainly a god of war, a bloodthirsty god, and worshiping him, you can imagine the circumstances involved in that. We also have, speaking of bloodthirsty, Molech of Ammon. Molech is a deity of Canaan known not merely for shedding blood, but shedding blood of true innocence. Molech worship is tied to infant sacrifice. I think I got this quote from the pulpit commentary. Writing about Molech and his worship, it says, he was the fire god, and the sacrifices offered to him were those of children. Children who would seem to have not only passed through the fire, but to have been burnt therein. I believe this is what the psalmist refers to in Psalm 106 when he writes about how that Israel, instead of crushing such worship, actually fell in with it. But they were mingled among the heathen and learned their works. Verse 36 says, and they served their idols, which were a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils. And they shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan. The land was polluted with blood. One point to make here is that idolatry ought not to be seen as just an innocent, well, it's just another way to God. It represents a way that is crushingly immoral, repressive, cruel, and opposite of the true God. A threat indeed. Now, if you were to see a crowd of idolaters, well, we wouldn't be pleased to see them coming our way. Folks who worship the gods we've just mentioned, for example. But it would be shocking indeed if we saw among that crowd somebody who had every reason to know better. I want to talk to you tonight and draw a quick lesson about maybe the world's most unlikely idolater. And of course, I'm talking about King Solomon. Because when you look at the scriptures, we find that Solomon was a man who gave himself to the worship of these very gods we've been talking about. You ever see somebody fall off the wagon and we just say, I never thought it would happen to them? I think all of us have had that experience, haven't we? We see people who make a turn and we just think, I can't believe they did that. I won't excuse anybody, but I can't believe that. It happened to Solomon. We remember the story. 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 5, for Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done. Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites on the mountain east of Jerusalem. Solomon? You don't mean it. He absolutely did. Hang in here with me. I want you to think with me about why would a man like Solomon do something like that? What would cause a person to turn to idolatry like Solomon? Well, I'll tell you one thing it wasn't. It wasn't tradition. It wasn't just, well, that's the way Solomon was raised, you know, and that's just the way it is. Some people, you know, they may have been raised that way. We don't make excuses for folks. But you think about Jezebel, for example. Jezebel created a lot of turmoil, a lot of problems, did a lot of damage. But she was, after all, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of Zidon. She grew up a Baal worshiper. And so that doesn't make what she did right, but maybe somehow it's less surprising. But Solomon doesn't have any excuse like that, does he? 1 Kings chapter 2, and in verse 1, when David's time drew near to die, he commanded Solomon his son, saying, I'm about to go the way of all the earth. You be strong and show yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways, keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do, wherever you turn, that the Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons pay close attention to their way and walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart as with all their soul, he says, you will not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Sometimes people go wrong and we might say to ourselves, I wish we'd have had one more talk with them. I wish we'd have said more to them. Well, I tell you, Solomon had the talk, and he knew what was right. He wasn't unaware of what God had told him. He grew up with the Ten Commandments. You think about how different it was to be an Israelite. Here are people who've grown up, and all they've ever known is that you worship God by fornication, by murder.
And then you read about a God who says, thou shalt honor thy father and mother. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet. You think about a God with that kind of standard of morality. And how different it was for Solomon. What could he say? And I tell you, Solomon had taken that to heart. He had been godly for a time, I think it's fair to say. By the way, don't you love that word godly? It's one of the great words, maybe even underused words in all the Bible. I'm sure you've noted this before, but somebody said, you know, the word godliness doesn't really mean God-likeness exactly. What it really means is God-wordness, W-A-R-D, like you talk about eastward or westward. It's what you face. Godwardness is what we're called to. Every day, we as His people look to Him. What will He have from us? It's the word that the apostle used in, is it 1 Timothy 3:15, when he describes, I think, the whole of Christianity in the expression, great is the mystery of godliness. The revelation of how we are to wake up every day desiring to know what would God have from us. And I tell you, Solomon knew what that life was. And I think he lived it for a time. Can you find maybe a more touching, there are a number of great passages, but what a great scene it is. Solomon, early in his reign, his father is dead, and Solomon has taken power, and he understands his own unworthiness. And so, wouldn't you love to have the President of the United States, any of them, with this kind of spirit? Oh Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in the place of David, my father. Although I am a little child and don't know how to go out or come in, and your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. Give your servant an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people? And it pleased the Lord. I think it was genuine. Now that was Solomon at one point in time. And then there's another great scene in Solomon's life. In chapter 8, you know, they're dedicating the temple, and Solomon speaks. He stands before the altar there in chapter 8. And in verse 23, he says, O Lord God of Israel, there's no God like you in heaven above or earth beneath, keeping covenant, showing your steadfast love. So he asked God to please remember his promise. You said to my father, you shall not lack a man to sit before me on the throne of Israel if only your sons pay close attention to their way. That's godliness. And I believe Solomon at this moment fit that description. Let me ask you this. You ever thought about, can you imagine if you could go back in time and talk to Solomon the day the temple was dedicated? And you could say to him, yeah, this year is an impressive place. It's a great shame that about 20 years from now you're going to be building a shrine to Molech. He probably had you arrested, don't you reckon? Probably hauled you off to jail for slander. You can't talk that way about nonsense like that about the king. That's exactly what happened. How did it happen? Well, he cannot blame his upbringing. He can't say nobody told him. He can't say he didn't know. He walked in the way. I'll tell you something else. It was not. It was not an intellectual matter. That is to say, none of us believe that Solomon, you know, after years of thinking about it and looking and exploring everything, said, I tell you, I just think that going out to the groves and worshiping Ashtoreth makes more sense than anything else a man can do. Nobody believes that. You remember what the Apostle Paul wrote in the New Testament in Romans chapter 1. He describes the folly of idolatry. He says, for though they knew God, neither glorified Him as God, nor gave thanks to Him, instead their thoughts turned to worthless things, and their senseless hearts darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images that looked like mortal human beings or birds or four-footed animals and reptiles. And for this reason, God delivered them to sexual impurity. They followed the lust of their hearts and dishonor their own bodies one with another. Solomon knew better than idolatry. Let me tell you, it didn't take the New Testament to reveal the folly of idolatry. Bear with me here a minute. I'm sure you're familiar with Isaiah 44. It's one of the great, to me, insights in how being close to Jehovah lets you see better than society at large can see. In an age when everybody just knew that bowing down before a statue and worshiping many gods was the way a man ought to make the afterlife a success, Isaiah points out the sheer foolishness of it. You remember Isaiah 44. Turn with me there if you will. And in verse 6, Isaiah writes, "Thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am first, I am last, I am only," he says. Just me. Nobody I need to advise me. So he says, where do these folks come from to create these gods that are not gods? Look in verse 9. "They make a graven image, and all of them are vanity, and their delectable things shall not profit. And they are their own witnesses, they shall not know, they see not, nor know, I should say, that they may be ashamed." Mark down their vanity, no profit, ashamed, no life in them. Who hath formed a god or a molten or a graven image that is profitable for nothing? Behold all his fellows, they shall be ashamed, the workmen, they are of men. You gather up all the people that are involved in the process of creating an idol, and all you'll find, he says, are men. He gives, for example, in verse 12, the smith. Here's the blacksmith. He takes the tongs and he works the coals and he fashions it with hammers. He works it with the strength of his arms. By the way, I'm not interested in getting any kind of arm wrestling competition going on with the blacksmith. Are you? Those fellows, they've got some muscle on them now as they have to swing a hammer all day in front of an open flame, as it were. But, he says, you know, if they don't drink water, they'll fall out. And if they don't eat, they'll faint. How can a man who has such limitations think he can make a god stronger than himself? And here's the carpenter. He stretches out his rule and he uses his skill, and what does he do? He makes it the figure of a man. But that's the problem with idolatry. A man cannot create God. All he can do is create what he is. That's one reason why we said the other night we know there is a God, because morality, the scriptures, lift us up where man could not dream to go. You have this woodworker. He goes down verse 14 and he hews down a tree. He selects his tree. Verse 15 begins to make use of it. But it's just a tree, nourished by the rain. Part of it he takes and he warms himself. Part of it he takes and he cooks with. He bakes bread. Part of it he uses to make a god. And he worships it. Think about that. Verse 16, he says, he burns part thereof in the fire. Part of it he eats his flesh with. And he roasted. He says, I'm satisfied. Part of it, he says, I'm warm now. And with the rest of it, he falls down and he says, deliver me, O God. They don't have knowledge, he says. They don't understand. They've shut their eyes. They cannot see. Their hearts, they've hardened. They cannot understand. None considers in his heart. Neither is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I've used part of it as a cook wood, part of it to warm the house. How can this be God coming from this? A man like that feeds on ashes. Falling down before the stock of a tree is not a lie in his hand. He doesn't recognize that. Now my point is that 700 years before Christ came, Isaiah knew that idolatry was folly. He knew that because of his association with Jehovah. You don't think that Solomon knew that? Solomon said, "Hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments." The point is, Solomon was not intellectually fooled. Well, what was it that caused Solomon to create this grievous sin? Well, you know what it was. It was passion. That's what it was. His wives turned away his heart. Go back to 1 Kings 11. You read in verse 1, Solomon loved many foreign women in addition to Pharaoh's daughter. He loved Hittite women, women from Moab and from Ammon and from Eden and from Zidon. They came from the nations about which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, never intermarry with them. They will surely tempt you to follow their gods. But Solomon was obsessed with their love. He had 700 wives, princesses, 300 concubines. In his old age, his wives tempted him to follow other gods, and he was no longer committed to the Lord his God, as David his father had been. Solomon the temple maker, Solomon the temple builder, Solomon the son of David, Solomon the leader, became so enamored with them that he lost sight of Jehovah. So here's the point of the lesson tonight. Young men, young women, among others, no matter what good upbringing you've had, and no matter how much you know, I don't know of any tool the devil has that's more effective in ruining and misleading and destroying young people than the wrong kind of influence from the opposite sex. I don't know any. We've got some good young folks at North Bibb. Don't have a big number, but we got some good quality. And I'll just say this, whatever it's worth, it is the thing that concerns, I can't think of anything that concerns me more for their future than this point. They're going to have folks that tell them what's right, and they're going to have a lot of help. But we've seen it, and we've seen it. Here's some young man, he might be starting out the wrong way, but you know, lo and behold, some young woman comes along who does not have the scruples that she ought to, and his head gets turned, and his mind gets turned, and his direction gets turned. Sometimes there's some young women, and they're just fine as they can be, and they're thinking right. And then, lo and behold, a young man comes along, and before you know it, it's an old story. How in the world did Solomon get involved in idolatry? The answer to that question is very relevant to all of us in this audience. All of us who might be yet looking for a mate, or one day might be looking for a mate, or have children ourselves growing up in our household, or grandchildren. The lesson that we find in Solomon's life is a warning to all of us. I like what Mr. Knox said in his translation of this passage. He said, Solomon gave his heart to many women. And in giving his heart to them, his heart was removed from God. The power of passion. The power of attraction. The person you date, the person you marry, is going to have a tremendous impact, obviously, on your life. For good or bad. That's why the decision has to be so important. Isn't it interesting that in a passage like 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33 that Paul says, evil companionships corrupt good morals. I wish we could say, you know, good companionships will straighten out evil morals in other people. Maybe it will sometimes, but it seems like the corrosive power of evil is pervasive. Relationships can and will change people, and so point of the lesson, simple as it is you have to exercise caution. So let me say something again to those who are younger. You need, as you think about, and I am all for marriage. We talked about that the other day. I'm for it. But you need, in choosing, to choose one who is a Christian to be a marriage partner. I feel strongly about that point.
If I had a young friend of mine who came to me and they said, you know, I want to marry this person who's not a Christian, I'd like for you to do the ceremony. My answer would be, I love you, but I cannot conscientiously do that. In fact, I really cannot conscientiously even attend, because I think this is not the direction you ought to go. Now, that sounds mean to some people. Why would I say something like that? I'd say it because I believe it. I'd say it because when I look at a young person starting out of home, recognizing the depth that we find in the Scripture of that relationship, Jesus said they're no longer two, they're one. God joins them together, and the two are one. Not just one flesh in the physical relationship, but they're one. That fleshly relationship, sex in marriage, is just a symbol of the closeness, the unity of these two that God has joined together. When you talk about that kind of closeness of relationship, what sense does it make for a young person who has Christ as the center of their life than to join themselves to someone who does not know Christ? That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it, when you think about it? You take a young person, a young lady, she's going to choose as the head of her household, this is the man who's going to be my head, I'm going to follow him as the Scripture teaches. A man that does not know Christ. A man that really, if I understand the Scripture, is not even in a praying relationship with God. Doesn't have that fellowship. You know, when Paul wrote about women's role in the assembly, for example, you remember in 1 Corinthians 14, he said that a woman is not to speak in the church. If she has a question, let her ask her husband at home. That's the way it ought to be. The kind of relationship where a man is a spiritual leader and a wife can safely find direction in him. She can't just follow him blindly, but he's there is that kind of influence. How can that be possible in the situation we're describing? This man does not know God. How is that going to be a help to her? What are we going to do about raising children? Well, they need to go to services. No, they need to play ball or stay home. And so you have the tug of war. You know exactly what I'm talking about. We've seen it before. And it breaks our heart. And what are we going to do about the money? Well, I believe we ought to give. Well, I don't think we need to worry about that. Well, I think we ought to live over here. Yeah, but there are no brethren over there. We're not working from the same spot. And a good young woman puts herself in a position by the choice she's made that she's going to have to fight that fight and fight it alone. That's why I say, no, I think that's a mistake. They might have a lot of good qualities, but I believe it's a mistake. Here's a young man. And he's going to choose for the mother of his children one day a woman who does not know Christ. Do you think anybody in the world is going to influence your children more than mama is? Don't you believe that? No, she's got an influence on them. Pray God it's the right influence. In the most important thing in the world, spiritually. That's why you look, when you look for a mate, for somebody who has that, you share that commitment with. When I try to preach on social drinking, you know, I think there's a lot of information that we might share about that subject. But one point that I make with, especially folks in the world, you know, they give you a hard time, you know, because you don't believe in drinking, but whatever. And I just tell them, I say, look, I have enough trouble doing the right thing sober. I don't know how in the world y'all think it's going to be good for you drunk or under the influence, whatever level it might be. I say the same thing here. I say, you know, it's hard enough to live in this world with two Christians together making a home and trying to raise up children without that situation that we all have seen where one person is trying to pull the wagon by themselves or maybe pull it in the opposite direction from the person that they love and that they have committed and vowed themselves to. So I say to young people, there are worse things than not being married. I love marriage. but find a person who will help you go to heaven. You know that, and you've heard that. Please don't ever forget it, ever. Let me bring that back one step further, if I might. You know, generally speaking, we marry the folks that we date. And so you have choices to make in dating. If you make those choices and make them the right way, it'll help you to avoid perhaps the pangs of heart that come. Because I know what's right, but I tell you, when you just look into those eyes and you get that feeling, it's hard to think about principle. That's the point. We have to make those decisions early and live by those principles. We have no right to be dating, for example, people who have no right to marry. Let me hasten to make this point, and you know it to be true. Let me tell you, there are some people that, according to the marriage law, have no right to marry that may not be guilty of anything. You know, in Matthew chapter 5, for example, in verse 32, our subject is the marriage law tonight. But you remember that Jesus said, I tell you, you've heard, don't give your spouse a right of divorce, but I tell you, whoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery. And whoso marries her that is put away or divorced commits adultery. In that passage we have a man, or let's take the woman. What's this woman guilty of? She's not guilty of anything unless she marries another. She's been put away and put away unjustly, maybe an innocent person. But if she takes a partner, then she's guilty of adultery. She's been put in a position by the unjust conduct of another, such that if she marries, she'll be in adultery. Folks in that circumstance would not wish to be dating. It would put too much temptation in front of themselves and in front of others. Again, our attitudes change whenever passion gets involved so many times. So in dating, those are decisions that we make. We're not dating someone who is rebellious to God. I told some of you the story before about a relative of mine one time who came to me and told me in this case that he was dating this girl with a cute temper. Well, how cute her temper was. And I thought, yeah, boy, you marry that cute temper. Boy, you're going to be sorry. And he did. You know, bad boy, but I can change him. Don't make that. Think more of yourself than that. Recognize the fact that you're looking for somebody who will be respectful of you and respectful of God. Oh, now, she's very religious. And I'm just sure, you know, I mean, she doesn't agree with me now, but I'm just sure that one day she'll see it. You reckon that's what Solomon thought? I don't know. I'd like to think that he was that concerned about it. Maybe he thought he was going to convert all those king's daughters too. It wound up the other way, though. And even if it hadn't, there never was any kind of common ground. So we plead with young folks to be demanding in terms of the choices that they make, to choose wisely. And let me just offer this. If I'm going to expect that much of the person that I date and marry, they ought to be able to expect that of me as well. Let me just offer that thought also. That you and I have to recognize that we have an obligation. That marriage, first of all, is for people who are adults. And so we need to be mature enough to make a right decision. Maybe I'll share this with you quickly. And you know what a sophomore is? You guys ever thought about the word sophomore? I wondered about that when I was in school. You know, I know what a junior is if somebody's not quite a senior. I know what a freshman is, and that's probably a freshman, but what's a sophomore? Actually, it's borrowed from the Greeks. The word sophomore we use comes from a combination of two Greek words. One of them, sophos, sophia, is the word for wisdom. And the other is the word moros, from which we get our word moron. And it's the opposite of that, and a fool. And so
the word sophomore is another way of calling a guy a wise fool, which is not really, you know, maybe that inaccurate a description of most young people. Not just 10th graders, but young people in general. Some young people are exceptionally mature. And some young people, most young people, have a lot of both foolishness and wisdom in them. That's the way it seems to work. And what we're hoping is that as quick as we can, we get less moros and more sophia. But my point is, while that process is going on, it's a bad time to pick a marriage partner. Marriage is for adults. Somewhere in this outline, I wanted to make, I'll make it now. Somebody might be sitting back and saying, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I tell you something. I've known a lot of cases where it worked out. I have too. And I'm not mad at those folks, by the way. If you married somebody who was not a Christian and they were converted and now they're strong and faithful, and I'm thrilled for you. And when I find people in that circumstance, I remember where Paul there teaches that the unbeliever is sanctified by their partner, which I take to mean that the marriage is just as valid as any other marriage, and do not leave your spouse because they're not Christians. That's not the right thing. You've made a commitment. So when I find people in those circumstances, I'm not their enemy. I'm their friend. I pray for them. I want to help them. I feel for them. I'm sorry for the struggle that they're in. I don't want them to quit. I want them to win. All that. And let me say this. I've known some folks who married Christians. Christians who married people who've been baptized. They didn't act much like Christians. And they split up. I performed some wedding ceremonies for folks, and everybody in it was baptized. They didn't last. And sometimes you think about that when you're trying to sleep too. I get all that. But I'm still saying to you that if you have a young person who's looking for the right thing and determined in themselves to be the right thing, you have the best opportunity to have the success that God wants us to have. That's obvious, isn't it? And if we're overconfident, fall into the trap that Solomon fell into. Let me say this. It doesn't just apply to young people, does it? I've known older people who might have been married a number of years. You've known these folks too through the years. And they lose their mate, and they might remarry, and they might choose badly. And it's amazing how sometimes folks who they might have been sitting in the pew for all these years, and then their spouse dies, they meet somebody else, and next thing you know, they're off in the bushes somewhere, and you think, how did that happen? Well, there might be a lot of answers to that, but certainly the influence of the spouse, the passion, did not help. Maybe that's why Paul in 1 Corinthians 7, at the end of that chapter, said a woman is bound to her husband while he lives, the King James says. If her husband dies, she's at liberty to marry whom she will only in the Lord. Or as this translation puts it, she is free to marry whom she likes, but let her be guided by the Lord. I think that's probably a pretty good paraphrase of it. I think what he's saying there is, let her decision be a decision that's based upon the will of God. Let her be careful about the choice that she makes, no less careful than the young person who's looking to marry for the first time. We don't need to become less careful, but more careful as time goes on, and set a good example for those who are younger. Well, you've listened patiently tonight to this simple exhortation, and I hope maybe something would be just a reinforcement of lessons that you've heard, lessons that you know. Solomon was a most unlikely idolater. It wasn't intellectual. That wasn't the problem. He had the smarts and the knowledge. It certainly wasn't his upbringing. He had a lot of help. The problem related to his hubris and his thinking that somehow he was invulnerable. Paul wrote many years later, these things happened to them as an example,
They are written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. They're given to us. These are not just interesting stories. Learn from it, Wesley. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed, lest he fall. What choice will we make in our life in reference to these things? We can choose a course that will lead to ruin if we want to. But one thing I can say, I can't say that I was not warned. Please get out your songbook and turn to the number that's been selected. If it be your desire tonight to obey the gospel of Christ, to be baptized into Christ, why not tonight let your wishes be known? Maybe you're here as one who, as a child of God, has strayed from Him. Then please return to Him. If we might be able to help you and assist you in that matter, then let us know how right now, while we stand, while we sing.